If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Chrissy Juno Mann is a UK-based embroidery practitioner and teacher with world-class skills and a fantastic storytelling ability. If you missed the first part of our interview last week, dial back and listen to that first, and then enjoy this episode where, among other things, we talk about Chrissy's phenomenal adventures that she had after she left university, which, honestly, hilarious. And we find out what her favourite book is, her favourite podcast. And also we talk about one of the creative challenges that she's got with her business, something we're able to, like, go through and kind of feel out. It's very rewarding to be able to talk with Chrissy and see, you know, it's quite hard to talk to someone and go, so what's going wrong with your business? But that's not what we do. We just sort of talk about the practicalities of business. You know, Needle Exchange is here to try and help you as creative people. If you want to move forward and turn your passion into a business, then Needle Exchange is on a mission to help you feel good about that and help you feel confident. And sometimes talking about issues like email newsletters or which marketing channels to use is something that is important, you know, something I'm interested in, and it's something I want to talk about as well. So we have a good dive around with Chrissy there. As I say, she's so good to talk to. I love talking to her, and her work is fantastic. So if you've not seen her work, go and find her on social media and just regale at her ability to combine unusual subject matter with world-class needlework. Chrissy's great. I love talking to her. I'd love to know your feedback. Feel free to leave a comment on the Mr. X Stitch Instagram or just drop me a line. hello@needle.exchange and let me know what you think. Thank you for being here. It's great to be part of your world. And I'll be back next week with a brand new interview with another fantastic needleworker. So until then, enjoy the show. So you went to uni. And what did you study at uni then? You said you talk about doing a lot of writing and stuff. What were you studying?
I did American literature. Yeah, it was because I wanted to combat my dyslexia with a literature. I thought, I really hate it when people say you can't do things. You know, it's like, yes, I can.
I'm sure you.
In fact, I struggled all the way through, you know, we'll just pass over that. I got there. That's the main thing. So, yeah, I did American literature. I also got a year in America. But that appealed to my travel bug, you know, so I ended up studying for a year in America. So I lived for a year in Colorado. But also, because I was a bit older, you can't hire a car in America when you're, you know, university age. But because I was older, I could hire a minibus, basically, and do all these road trips with people. And, I actually ended up going traveling with a girl who was about 18, and I was 30 at the time, and we just had a blast, you know. We went. She was really fluffy. She kept losing all our money, but, you know, we went to Mexico, and Guatemala, and Costa Rica, you know, and it was just really fun. Yeah, so, yeah, I'm kind of adventurous like that. I do like an adventure. And when I came back, I felt like, when you go traveling, what is it? I was trying to think what I liked about traveling, and it's sort of, it is that little sort of, it's, you know, in essence, I kind of wanted to include some of that traveling aspect into my life. And it's that exploring of the new, isn't it, I think? And that sort of freedom where you don't have to be who you are, you can be someone else slightly. And so I ended up doing lots of micro adventures, and I still do them now, really, like doing little mini micro adventures. It might just be a day. I think other people call them day trips. I don't call them a day trip.
No, micro adventure sounds really cool.
I call them micro adventures. I'm always texting, do you want to come on a micro adventure to a friend? No, I don't, not one of yours. So around him, I went to Gloucester not that long ago, and I did dog sledding. Because I found somewhere you could do dog sledding with, you know, like tricycle thing. And she was like,
amazing.
Yeah. This woman was like a leading dog sledder for the UK, winning awards. And yeah, so I went there and did a little bit of training. And that was really fun. So it's like these weird, random things. I just set off in the car, put it into the sat nav, and just go and see what the day unfolds, really. So I like that.
So cool. So where was the transition then from like American literature to the Royal School of Needlework? How did that come about?
Well, the thing with Brighton, when you go to live in Brighton, you think you're going to have a normal life, and you go there thinking I'll do a 9 to 5, 5 days a week, and the majority of people end up doing part time because they get too involved with all the other stuff like the beach and drink and drugs. Basically, so
allegedly,
I didn't get involved with drink so much, but I did basically go part time. So I actually got a job after university with Sussex Probation doing. I used to run community service projects, and they did all the hours in 4 days, and that ruined me because then I had a 3 day weekend, and that I never wanted. So and I enjoyed it because it was really creative. I made it really creative. We did like sensory gardens, and we did, you know, painting the Buddhist center, and then they got a meditation session. I mean, all these big burly I don't want to be here offenders with their, you know, 300 hours to go and paint the Buddhist center, or we went to an animal sanctuary. So it was all I sourced the projects, and then I ran them twice a week with the group. So it was a learning curve, let's put it that way. But then to do the whole tango man, you know, and put them all in orange boiler suits, which wasn't really, I'm not really up for that. I was, you know, more about rehabilitation than, you know, humiliation. So I sort of changed direction. I went to Sussex University. But then, you know, because I'd had these 3 days a week and I just kept doing art all this time. So I was still doing all these evening classes. And then because I had 3 days, I was doing more and more art. Well, I wasn't going to get a full-time job. I ended up a part-time job. And then I ended up going traveling again. And then, oh no, it's not a great track record. I've never really
been. That's great. I'm so jealous.
Not being a brilliant employer. Even when I worked at Sussex Uni, I used to sit near a window, and they've got a thing called Stanmer Park. It was brilliant. And my manager was in another building. So I used to say, oh, I'm just off to see my manager. And I used to go for a walk in the park because I hated being in an office so much. I used to ring home and go, what is the point of my life? You know. Brilliant. I was like, I was destined to work for myself. I'm much more motivated working for myself. So, yeah, I went traveling, and I went to Africa, and I had an accident, basically. So I had a riding accident in Africa, which was, it's quite comedy, to be honest. I got my foot caught in a stirrup and got dragged Yeah, no, it was really serious. I could have been killed so easily, but...
we laugh now.
Yeah, exactly. Fortunately, the stirrup broke. My body concertinaed. I, you know, was sort of on the ground, and I got surrounded by about, I don't know, 50 Africans. And then they were jumping in and hitting my side. And basically, they were trying to restore my, you know, revive my spirit or something. But basically, in among all of that, my ribs were broken. They were hitting broken ribs. And I was lying there going, ah! And punctured my lung as well. So, yeah, I ended up, well, I ended up self-caring, really. And somebody's home with an amazing Great Dane who just wouldn't leave my side. And then I paid someone about $100 American to take me to the capital because I was going to fly home. And they hadn't got any petrol, a petrol shortage. So they were pushing the car up the hill, freewheeling down. It's like, I suppose I'm still here. Anyway, then I randomly, it was a moment of kindness. It was the only kind of, you know, moment I've had where I thought, maybe there is a God, because I'm not a believer. Mm-hmm. I'm spiritual. And it's the poorest of the poor road sweeper. I was just there by this curb, kind of starting to cry because I couldn't lift my bag and my ribs. And I just, and she came and just stood by me with her broom and held my hand. And it was just, you know, it just broke my heart slightly. And we must have looked so weird. And then a man came up to me and he said, "Are you okay?" And he turned out to be an orthopedic surgeon from South Africa. I was in Malawi. And he said, you know, he was with his wife. He said, "Would you like me to look at your injuries?" And I said, "Yes." And so I bound myself with a sarong. That's all I'd done, was just bound. And he said, "I think, you know, you've got blood in your lung and you need an operation." I said, "Well, don't worry, I'm going to fly tomorrow." And he was like, "You cannot get on a plane because it will kill you." And it was such a weird moment where, you know, all these random things came to play. So he settled me into a hospital, but it was, that was a nightmare. It was just a hard surface, and relatives brought in food and water, so there was nothing. I got, ended up being really delirious. And he said, "Whatever you do, do not have an operation here. You've got to go to or to South Africa because the risk of infection is too high." And and the top surgeon in this hospital came in, and he had a little figure drawn on a board, and he was like putting a cross. "We are going to do an operation here." And I was like, "No, no, you're not." But fortunately, this guy, my guardian angel, really, he also kicked in my insurance. And finally, a medical plane flew me to Kenya. And I ended up in Kenya for 2 weeks having surgery, my lung drained. And then I got flown back to the UK. So anyway, that's a long story. You can edit that.
Wow.
I know, it's so random. But I just didn't want to go back to work. I just thought, you know what, that was a bit of a near miss for me. Don't fancy work anymore. So I literally went in, told my boss I hated her, and left. And I've never had a proper job since, really. And, yeah, I went off to the Lake District and lived in a youth hostel. Like, there were a couple of other dropouts there, and walked the hills, and it sort of fixed my lungs and, you know, revived my spirit. And then I just thought, I really only want to make things and do craft. And then I just sort of went back to my roots of what I really wanted to do, which was, you know, embroidery. I did think it'd take about a year to sort myself out. It probably took more like 8.
Right, okay.
Well, maybe a little less than that, but it took quite a while. It wasn't quite as quick a process as that. But that's it in a nutshell. That's how I've ended up. I did do an MA in between. So I've got an MA in antique restoration and conservation. And
of course.
I thought that would be fun. You know, I love the idea of that. I did like working in a studio, but there was a recession on at the time as well, and it was difficult with the hours getting work. But I worked on 2 English sleeping chairs from Tudor times, really, the 1600s, and they were from Holyrood House. So I was really fortunate because they were from the Royal Collection, and I had all these ideas about doing, you know, finding replica fabric and, you know, doing all the upholstery. But I ended up doing so much woodwork. I'm really good at woodwork now. Because they were really... When they said Royal Collection and they said, you know, English sleeping chairs, I just thought, it's going to be a bit like a throne. And a bit of gilt, you know, be a bit bling, be lovely. Anyway, they got them out the truck. And then, honestly, they looked like they'd lived in a bush for, you know, 400 years. They were like hideous and so disgustingly dirty. And I thought, I don't really like them. But anyway, there were massive monsters I ended up working on. So, yeah, I kind of don't know if I quite enjoyed my MA, but it was interesting. And there was lots of learning and there was lots of making. So all that was nice. But
and I guess it all accumulates, doesn't it? It all adds up to something. You know, you've got that. Because I suppose as well, doing the work with the RSN, like even now you're still doing it, and they do a lot of conservation work, don't they? So
yeah, they do, exactly. But I don't work in the studio. I mean, I live a little bit far away, and it's probably not my favourite thing to do, really. I haven't got the interest mending older things as I have in making new decorative things. I prefer that, really. Mm. That is how I ended up going to the RSM, because then I thought, okay, I'm not going to do this MA, you know, follow it through completely, but what is related? And then, yeah, I ended up just going back to my roots, which, you know, it takes a lifetime sometimes to discover what you want to do, doesn't it?
So, I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing to think, you know, you did your 10,000 hours probably by the time you're about 13 or something like that. You know, I love that. It was clearly, I mean, when you got back into it, when you started doing the stuff at the RSN, did you like feel like you were back in the right space again?
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah, I just took to it. I just don't get bored of it, really. I mean, I do think, you know, it is, I know I need to write an essay on whether embroidery is an addiction or an obsession, you know, which of those it is. I think maybe it's a combination of the two, because it's you know, I think because it's a meditative flow, isn't it? Lots of people say, oh, it's like meditation, but it's not meditation, because meditation is stationary and internal breathing. But a meditative flow, where flow practice is where you do gentle movement all the time, and it is that, and that then releases dopamine, and that's what you get from doing, you know, endurance sports or all those sort of things. And it is, and I think that's what everyone's slightly obsessed with. Slightly obsessed with the kick you get from the dopamine, you know, that sort of keeps going, oh, I want to do more embroidery. It's actually what they want is the dopamine.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. Like I've been part of a running club, and you see the people who run 5-6 times a week, and if they don't run for a little while, or I even know it, like I did a marathon years ago, and you have to do so much running and you get so much endorphins from that, that when you stop, you start to come down from it. And it's the same kind of thing with that, isn't it? It is a bit of an addiction to something that is good for you. It's a funny thing to have, but I think you're quite right. It's good for your soul. It just makes you feel good, and you just want to do it all the time.
Yeah, I really feel like if Sherlock Holmes was around, he would have been an embroiderer. You know, that's my feeling. Because he, you know, well, he loved needles, didn't he? He loved his opium. And I feel like, you know, that meticulous mind and that sort of structure, he would have enjoyed the process a lot. But also he was creative in the way he thought about problems. So I feel. And actually, Conan Doyle, isn't it, the author? He's actually buried in the New Forest. Slightly random, tenuous link there, but
I guess you can't choose, but I wonder, do you have a favourite needlework type? Was there stuff that you learned that really, like, really resonated, things that you were so glad you kind of discovered?
I think canvas is a comfort zone type work. It does remind me, it's very nostalgic. It reminds me of my childhood. But I do really like a sort of slightly 3D piece. And I do like sort of fiddly little things. I like all fingers and thumbs, you know, work. So I do enjoy that. And I like it when people look at things and go, how did you do that? So I quite enjoy that little buzz, you know, from that. I wouldn't have thought I was a gold rope person. I'm not very blingy. I'm quite a tomboy, really, and I'm very outdoorsy. But I do like a bit of gold, you know, it's a little highlight. So that was a surprise to me that I liked gold work. I can't remember what the question was, to be honest.
It was just if there are certain techniques that you like really kind of got excited by, that kind of thing.
I guess stump work gold work combo probably is one that I really enjoy. Yeah, and then the sort of crawl work, you know, the Jacobean style and the canvas, a sort of more comfort zone, nostalgic feeling. Yeah, hot chocolate.
Do you prefer teaching those? Are there, you know, some techniques that are much more satisfying to teach because of what happens to the learner?
I love teaching my Jacobean design. That is so fun. It's such a fun day and it's really interactive. And initially, when I first started, I'd sort of try and manage expectations and say to people, you know, okay, we're going to do a design. You know, not everyone's, a lot of people aren't, you know, even drawers, they feel, you know, and they're nervous about the class. So I was like, you know, it might not finish by the end of the day, all that sort of thing. Anyway, I don't say that anymore. By lunchtime, most of them are, you know, well on their way. They have an outline. They're sort of tucking in, and it's really amazing. By the end of the day, people have things, you know, really getting them down. They might need to fine-tune stuff, but they're really, really getting down to it. So, but I bombard them with a lot of images that they can draw on, you know, and inspire. So it's like the design days that I run are a bit like a saturation. It gets saturated and then, you know, regurgitate. So glamorous.
But I love it because, like, at the start when we were saying, you know, how can you talk for 5 hours about a thing? But I've got absolutely no doubt now how you can do it, because you'll just go, someone will go, I've been to Africa, and you go, I've got a funny story about Africa. And 45 minutes later.
I do have to manage myself.
The course is the main backbone of how you like construct your business now. Is that kind of the main part of your living now?
Yeah, the courses are how I make money, really. Teaching, I do various types. So I do retreats. I'm actually going off to retreat at the end of next week into Wales to a castle. So it's a week, you know, where people come along and learn to stitch. So that's with a different organisation. I do Marlborough College, go there. I'm doing 2 weeks retreat next year. I go to the French Alps with Creative Experiences, do a week there. That was nice. Very nice. Yeah, they're really lovely. Food's amazing. You know, it's just a really relaxed atmosphere to work in, and everyone wants to have a nice time because it's basically their holiday. So it always works out well. So I like the retreats, and then I do mainly Zoom. Before COVID, I was going more to do workshops. I was even going up to the RSN to work there, but I don't generally do that now. Basically, I'm sort of on the long arm of their Zoom. And really, I do a lot of my own Zoom too. So COVID's kind of, I'm one of those businesses that COVID made, really, because it enabled me to not rely on others. I was able to rely on myself for work. So I'm quite good at networking because I'm quite sort of chatty.
you could say that.
Yeah. So basically, I can kind of get into places quite easily, sort of rock up and say hiya. But I don't need to necessarily. And some places don't do that so much now anyway. So, Zoom and COVID kind of worked for me. In fact, I really loved the COVID to start with. It was so nice just having that break from everything, wasn't it?
In a manner of speaking for many of us, yeah. I think it's interesting. And I was always really proud. I had this conversation with them maybe yesterday or something. You know, even the RSN managed to pivot. Like a lot of these organizations, COVID forced their hand a bit. But I was really pleased with the way they managed to do it, because there's a lot of jeopardy, you know, even with like the Embroiderers Guild as well. You know, I know that they suffered a lot of losses of their members through COVID. But even they managed to pivot, and when you're a quite long established organization like that, it's not necessarily the easiest thing to go, suddenly we need to be able to deliver digital products like that. But it's really nice to see them come out the other side of it.
And it's made me international. That's what another thing. So, you know, like I have a stitch club that I run, which is international, and they're actually a brilliant support group too. They're like my little community, and it's every other Sunday, and we're doing a group project actually for the Broderers exhibition, so that'll be nice. But, you know, it's in the morning for America or Sweden, it's in the afternoon a bit later, you know, but for the UK, it's in the afternoon, you know, and it just enables, you know, so many people from around the world, which is not something I never considered before, really, being able to do. And that sort of opened things up as well. So the other thing, I suppose, the other, going back to the business side, is the other thing is in COVID, I decided to write my own black workbook. Mm-hmm. Basically, I wasn't keen on a lot of the black workbooks because they don't suit me visually, because it's difficult to read the patterns, the way my eyes work, mainly due to my dyslexia. I can't sort of pull out the patterns unless they're a bit clearer. So it seemed really obvious to me. I just needed to enlarge them, make the patterns, and I highlight where the needle goes in and out with a coloured square. I mean, it's not rocket science, and it's just really visually easy to read, and that works really well. So, and then I sort of sent it to Inspirations magazine, and they picked it up, and they've been really supportive, and then they encouraged me to write another one, and, you know, now it's selling in South Korea and America and Australia. I mean, it's still a self-published book, so it's been a lot of learning. I've had to learn InDesign and Illustrator. I've had, you know, work out. But the book does really well, and that's something I really enjoy. So, yeah, I definitely think books going forward will be something I enjoy doing.
I think it's quite fascinating what you say there about the dyslexia, because I guess a lot of the time people just assume dyslexia is to do with, like, words and numbers and stuff, but it's interesting that patterns are the challenge, isn't it? I guess a letter is effectively a pattern of symbols, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's why people can't spell, because they can't remember the pattern of the letters, you know, the order they make. So I can't necessarily spell out loud, but I could type using my fingers because I can remember the muscle memory of the pattern on the keyboard. So I'm much better typing a word than I would be spelling it out loud. But I mean, you know, I've kind of got so many things in place to combat all of that. I mean, I was considered severely dyslexic when I was younger, and I couldn't read very well because my eyes wouldn't follow a line of text. They would jump down a couple of lines and then jump up, so nothing made sense, and so I didn't really start reading until a lot later. And I always used a lot of audio books when I was younger, which I still do today. Obviously, they're much cooler today. When you were younger, they weren't quite so cool, but cassette player when I was younger. But so I guess it is that sort of, you know, when you're stitching black work, obviously it's very easy to make a mistake with the needle, but at the same time muscle memory kicks in, and the pattern, you know, you don't have to count all the time. I often say to people, you only need to count to 3, 5, or 7 really. But, you know,
because that's what I was wondering, really. Black work is, isn't it? Because you've just got this pattern repeat, it's, you know, akin to cross stitch, isn't it? It's a very simple one to get to grips with, and then you've just got to, I guess, know when to stop that particular version of the pattern, right?
Yeah, or break it down, or, you know, sort of deconstruct it, so then you can sort of peter it out and feather it, type thing. And then, you know, if you have a blank space, in theory, you're supposed to be able to put all the stitches in and then continue to the other side, so that it's not just a blank space and then you're starting randomly. I'm sure that's not necessary. I think that might be an RSN rule that they've made up to make things harder.
Just controversial questions just popped into my head, but I thought I'd ask it because I've seen you talk about it on Instagram. How do you feel about the back of your work?
Oh, well, I really like the back of my work. I mean, it's pretty neat.
I mean, I mean, of all the examples to go for, least car crashy back of her work ward goes to.
But I do like it. I think it's got its own sort of texture and feel. And in some ways, you know, like when you paint, like I really love a painterly artist, you know, not someone, if I painted, it's a bit uptight. You know, I want to be free stroke, but I'm just not that person with paint, you know. I find it difficult. But it's sort of like that. In a way, it's the painterly version of your work, the back of it, because it's a slightly, you know, abstract, organic kind of, you know, not controlled, you're allowing the thread to sit how it wants to sit type side of things. So probably the downside of embroidery is the tightness of it at times and the controlled element. Certainly in my work anyway, I feel like, you know, that is who I am, I suppose, and what I know to some degree on how I express myself, but it's not necessarily how I live my life. So in a way, it's a bit weird. Maybe it's the only thing I can control, so that's why I do it. So I was a bit all over the shop in life.
It's funny, right? So, yeah. It just popped into my head that as a random question, I think, because it's so funny. I think it's just, maybe it's just something about, you know, a job well done is worth celebrating. And I guess back in the day, people were a lot more hung up on the pristine and the prim and the proper, perhaps, you know, spinning back 200 years or whatever. But it's such a thing. I don't think modern people who start stitching necessarily think about the back of the work. But somewhere down the line, someone's going to go, the back of your work's supposed to be really good, isn't it? Like, it's like a little old lady knows somebody or something.
I do think there's a longevity to it, though. So if you've got a thread, you know, over time it will weaken. Whereas if you've got that, so if it's just strung across the back, it will just sort of hang there and weaken, maybe. And that might weaken the front and change the effect on the front. Whereas if you thread it behind things and secure it, then that thread has got more chance of stability. So in a way, you're building in stability for longevity, I think, if you do a neater back. But then if you're not too worried about what's going to happen to it, then, you know, I mean, you can have these rules, but, I mean, rules are there to be broken, aren't they? You know, I'm a firm believer. You know, we learn the rules and then you do what you want with it because it's an art form. And, you know, and therefore the rules go out the window as soon as it becomes that. So you can learn techniques and that's great because that can help you progress and achieve what you want to achieve. But then when it comes to making your piece, you know, because I often hear that, you know, people say, oh, I'm supposed to do it like this and I really wanted to do it like that. And I'm like, you do it how you want to do it. You have to live with it. It's going to be on your wall, you know. If it's going for marking or something like that, you need to make a decision. You either do it how you want to do it and accept that you might lose some marks, or you toe the line and you do it the other way. So the choice is yours.
But then once you get past that point of being marked, you can just go gangbusters, dead birds, in canvas work, whatever you like, really.
Yeah. I always regret, I did a canvas piece of a girl's head. It was like a fashion magazine piece. And you know, it was a really lovely blue coat and it was really textured collar. And I didn't, and it was for the RSN for grading, and I didn't want to put eyes in, but that was just a bit too weird for them. But for me, that was like, oh no, I really like her without eyes. And then I stitched eyes, and I just knew, you know, eyes are tricky anyway, and with canvas, you're not going to get great eyes. And they weren't amazing, and they ruined it, basically. And of course, it'd be difficult to unpick it. And so now I just hang on to the photo with her eyeless, you know, eyeless face. Because the real feature isn't the eyes. The feature is the colour, and the feature was her bob hair. The eyes and her expression just weren't actually relevant for the picture. But
I remember talking to, I think it was Danielle Clough, fiancé Knowles, who does a lot of portraits. And I think she, and a lot of portrait artists do that. Jane Sanders, Stitching in the Kitchen, you know, they always start with the eyes. So if you take that idea, and then what you're saying is, if you don't start with the eyes, don't do the eyes. It seems to be the good rule.
Yeah, maybe. I have to try that.
So it feels to me like you're in a really good place with like the work that you do and the ability to make art and stuff. Are there any like challenges that you're facing at the moment in terms of like the way you do things?
Yeah, I do think what I don't like is I don't like being on a hamster wheel just churning things out, you know, because I don't like that feeling. It feels too regimented and too like a job, and I don't like that. So you know, I have been, and because I want to make more time, I've been wondering about how I can divide that time up, you know, whether it would work if I spent 6 months not teaching but producing kits and things, and to then have a period of teaching But then I'm not doing any other stitching, and therefore I could do my stitching. Or, you know, trying to find the balance where I am producing stuff that I can use commercially, but I'm also finding the time to do my thing as well. That is a tricky balance. That and social media, generally.
Just all of social media. With the courses, so are all of your courses, like, in person, you're there in the same space as the same people?
Online, yeah.
And is there ever, could you ever do a sort of self-medicating, you know, could you video tutorials and have those so that people can learn from you without you being in the room?
Yeah, I have done one for the RSN that did go well, and I have bought a rig, small rig recently. So I've been teaching myself iMovie editing and like doing little mini films, mainly in the forest, actually. It's because I want to improve my website too, to make it. I mean, really, I haven't been going that long, actually, in a professional sense. So it's only about 5 years. People often think it's a lot longer. I think that's just because I've done a lot of stitching. But in terms of little business, I haven't really. So I feel like a 5-year period is a good time to sort of think, okay, what do I want? And actually, that is one of the things I've been thinking about. Trying to video them, set it up so I stitch under the camera and then provide them.
Yeah, but that's where I wonder whether there's like a hybrid model, because it's clear that half of what people are doing is paying to be in a room with you, which is going to be an amazing thing regardless. But you do wonder whether some of the tutorials, whether you structure it so that you bookend it with a session with you at the start and you at the end, but in the middle you've got these self-service courses, or even you have that as an option for people who don't feel like they want to be in a certain space and time, because then they're still learning from you. But that's like that sort of evergreen content thing, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's actually quite a good idea. Yeah, try and do a middle bit, because it's international, it is difficult with timings for people, because sometimes I've done a course which I think is really, you know, it's a really, you know, appealing design, but it hasn't taken off. And I think, well, why is that? And sometimes I think, is it because of the timings I'm doing, or is it because, you know, it's not advanced enough, or is it because, I mean, I don't think it's because it's an ugly image, because I think most of them are quite cute and somebody surely will like it. That's what I generally think. If I like it, surely someone else will like it. That's my theory on everything.
I'm not very good at this myself, but do you ever sort of ask your... Because you've got an email newsletter, haven't you? And I know you're always sharing things. I'm even sure you shared about the prize on it at one point. Thanks very much. But, I mean, do you have much of a back and forth with the people that you email?
No, I am quite open to emails. People do email me questions, but mainly it's probably with my Stitch Club that I get the most feedback. You know, they sort of, I mean, actually my Stitch Club's like a counselling session for me. They just support my ego massively.
It's not necessarily the right people.
Any self-doubt, they're bolstering me up, you know, they're brilliant. So that's sort of, so they're sort of my... what do you call it when you have a little trial audience to test ideas out on?
Yeah. They're sort of, they are like that. They're a test audience, aren't they? But I suppose the tricky thing sometimes is then when they're also a fan club, they don't give you the criticism that you might necessarily need to kind of get them, isn't it? That's why I've got a wife, it would appear, because anytime I have an idea, I go to her and she goes, no, that's dreadful. She's kind of what you need to hear sometimes.
One student who... I'm very fond of, and she will always say, like, she came away to the French Alps with me, who most of them didn't know me, and somebody said, oh, I'm not quite sure how to do that, and I could just hear in the background constantly going, that's because she's a rubbish tutor. And just, she's like a heckler. Just heckles me constantly.
That's what you need.
I just batter away constantly.
What you were saying before about like how you've had to redefine the blackwork pattern thing to make it easier for you. And then I wonder whether, because you're now able to like self-publish your own books, if you did a blackwork tutorial video set that kind of accompanies that, then you're giving people those two different layers of learning, aren't you? Which is almost like a complete module in and of itself that you could sell to people. So they could buy the book, but if they wanted to pay a bit more, they could buy the book and the video tutorial together. And then if off the back of that, they're really into it, then maybe they can come and do a live session with you at some point. It might mean you can like stretch out the frequency of your live appearances to give you a bit more breathing space.
Yeah, that's true. I do find time. The thing with what I do is it's not easy to churn out quickly. Making time is, you know, is an issue. I need to be a bit more disciplined. She pulls a face.
I mean, it feels to me like you're probably quite disciplined. Or is that one of those, like, well, actually, no, you've said yourself you're just going to go off and do some bungee jumping from a bridge in Dorset in 10 minutes' time or something. So maybe it's that.
Well, I won't do that one. But yeah, I probably, you know, I feel like I've done this and I'll go, oh, I need to go for a walk now, you know. Rather than get with more work. I think I stitch in small chunks. I don't sit for hours at a time stitching. So I don't work as in, I work every day rather than in, you know, 3 days a week I'll stitch. And I don't know whether that would be more, I'd achieve more or not doing it that way.
I mean, I think sometimes if you're talking about stitching from your own artistic standpoint, though, you have to go with your flow. Like we talked about that, and we say you shouldn't force yourself to sit in the chair a moment longer than you don't feel it, because otherwise it's the wrong kind of output. But it sounds as though you're looking for more strategic, you know, rebalancing the business commitments in as much as, you know, and that's where that thing of, you know, if you're saying about doing another book, if part of that process you decide to video, because you'll be taking top down shots for your book anyway, so maybe you video it and take stills instead, and then you've got those two things built in as part of that process, and over time just chip away at those and you'll probably have something.
Yeah.
Because it saves you having to teach the same thing in real life over and over again, kind of, doesn't it? Then you can get down to the fun creative bits and be in the room with people when they need it.
Yeah, that's true. No, it's a good idea. I definitely hope to try and do a bit more with the film, because I haven't really done a lot of reels or anything like that. So I hope, I wouldn't say I was great with social. I'm quite a private person, really, although I've just pulled my guts on this. I'm great on a one-on-one, but you know, I'm not. You know, I don't share massive amount about myself on social media. So I think, you know, I've sort of been a bit reluctant in the past. I think I need to break it down a bit more and try.
But the thing is you don't have to make yourself a celebrity. Like I found it quite handy to have Mr. X-Stitch as a kind of pseudonym. Because Mr. X-Stitch is all magnificent and talks like this, whereas Jamie Chalmers is a lot more normal, and sometimes that's a useful tool. And so, you know, you don't have to be the face of Cloud Juno if you don't want to, even though you are, but do you know what I mean? You don't have to be It's About Me.
Yeah. Yeah, probably not super comfortable with that, although I think most people go, why not? You know?
It's funny, isn't it? Because like once you're warmed up, you're like gangbusters. Like I can imagine, like you say, sitting down and doing. But this is the thing. Like maybe it's like Instagram reels and stuff. Maybe that's not the right context. Whereas a Facebook Live is the right context. And you have to think about also like the demographics. Like I feel like Instagram. I don't like to put my face on Instagram. You feel like Instagram's meant to be all like polished and, you know, the Instagram version of events and stuff. Whereas even like TikTok, and I'm not saying get into TikTok, but like even that is now a bit more honest. You get a bit more warts and all on TikTok, which makes it easier to kind of sit with. But it might be like you being the host of your weekly show on Facebook Live is the thing that kind of really, because that's where your people are at as well.
Yeah. Well, I do like the bi-monthly newsletter thing. I like a bi-monthly. That works well for me because it just takes the pressure off slightly to come up. I only have to come up with 6 ideas rather than 12. And that just feels much more doable. Although I can come up with the ideas, you know, it makes it, you know, I've been able to maintain it and keep it going in a sort of similar vein. So that's worked really well. That's been one of the really good things I've done. And that people really
Your newsletter have the same format each time? Do you do the same kind of things each time?
Yeah, yes, basically. It's normally one article which is tenuously linked to embroidery. I mean, one of them about road signs of London. So, you know, like Red Street or... and then I rambled on about night, you know, because there's a street called Knight Rider, Knight's Lane, that's it, Knight's Lane. Knight's Lane. And basically, it made me think of Knight Rider, but it had nothing to do with Kit the car. Basically, where the knights would cross over this bridge to go to their jousting competition. I mean, I love that. But anyway, and then there's like, if you go to Mortlake, the area of Mortlake, there's a lane called Tapestry Lane, and you go down there, then there's a plaque down by the river of Mortlake, where, you know, the tapestries that were done by Mortlake in the sort of 1600s, that is where the factory was, the tapestry factory, so where all the Flemish came over. Wow. So I kind of like that sort of treasure hunt. So I send people on a bit of a treasure hunt on that one. So sometimes it's a bit random. Sometimes it's about specific, you know, an exhibition or something. And I'm branching out myself by getting more quotes, trying to do a little bit of an interview. I really enjoy it. It's really fun. So, yeah.
I suppose in some ways that does, that goes to that writing thing that you were talking about at the start as well, isn't it? It's an opportunity for you to have your own, just do a bit of a writing for people for pleasure.
Yeah, exactly. And also it's really good for research, you know, it forces me to research something to keep my knowledge sort of up and fresh and, you know, and I might go to an exhibition and I just see something and then I latch onto that and then broaden it up. I mean, I think one newsletter I decided to write like I was Jane Austen, like, you know, in the tone of... So, oh, what have we here? Kind of thing.
I love it. I love the because sometimes like newsletters can be a bit sincere. So I think if you go a bit wackadoodle on them, I think that that's really good because I think it just fits in. And that's clearly that's the bit of you that people love the most. Technical skills notwithstanding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think they like the fact it's not a. I'm not selling really. It's a soft sell newsletter. I'm not selling constant work at them or going come and have a discount, you know. I'm just sort of giving them a fun read really. Something they're interested in, which is embroidery. So
and it feels like that's a really good fit because that's sort of you can use a newsletter as a sales tool, but it doesn't mean you should always use, you know, like I quite like to send out more newsletters because if I send out a monthly one and I switched to doing a weekly one, I've gone from like 12 chances to sell a thing to 50 chances to sell a thing. But that's, I'm quite at peace with that. And mine are really short and essentially pointless, whereas yours are a bundle of fun. And it sounds like it's a very natural, you know, part of that process.
Yeah. And I do, you know, they are informative. I have a column down the side where I try and, you know, sum up what's going, like, you know, like your competition or other events that I'm doing. And plus, I send them in an email so I can put things into the email. So, you know, in a roundabout way, it does, you know, tell people what I'm doing, really. But it's just not it's not boring. It's definitely not boring.
Well, I'm a subscriber, so I'd recommend everybody signs up to the newsletter, dig into the surface. I'm going to pivot to the important questions now. Now, at the end, I usually ask what's an interesting fact that nobody knows about you? But I'm not sure that falling off a horse in Africa and being flown to a different country in Africa to get your ribs repaired could necessarily be beaten. I am also inclined to do a separate episode called Let's Talk About Interesting Things That Nobody Knows About Chrissy Juno Man and do a 3-hour version of that because I think that could totally work. So I might just go for the other ones because I feel like we're good. We'll see what happens. But because you said you did American literature, do you have a favourite book?
Well, I do, but I haven't put American book in particularly. But I did have a think about the books that I liked. And actually, I think they've all got a bit of a theme. Really, going back to school, I liked Kes. And then I like Call of the Wild, Jack London. And I like Life of Pi. Or I like I love The Old Man and the Sea, Hemingway. And they're all really... you know, it's basically, they're all nature-based, but sort of, you know, battling the elements or sort of coming to terms with, you know, nature in some way, you know, sort of, I can't even describe it really, but that sort of theme really, where you're having a relationship with another living thing that isn't human, and it's sort of, you know, it's you're having a relationship with their spirit really, which, you know, whether it's the spirit of an animal or, you know, the sea, or although that old man in the sea was with a Merlin, wasn't it? Or whether you're, you know, called the wild, and that was written from the point of view of the dog and his journey to becoming pack leader, that sort of thing. So it's sort of all, they're all kind of adventurous, really, adventurous journeys which incorporate nature. I did read last summer, which was sort of the height of when my mum had dementia was getting worse, and I went to the beach a lot, which was a real calling for me to go and sit on the beach. And I read there's an owl and the nightingale, and it's basically a Tudor poem which is written, or translated I should say, by Simon Armitage, is it? Simon Armitage.
Okay. And poet laureate. And it's,
Yeah. So he translated this. He's translated the poem, which sounds weird, doesn't it? Because it's from Tudor England, but there's a sample of the language, and it's just, you know, you couldn't read it. So it does take a lot of translating, and it rhymes. And it's basically, I'm going in an area that I don't really know, but I feel like it's like a rap. It's like a Tudor rap where they're riffing off each other. And it's like the owl, you know, kind of baiting the nightingale, and, you know, they're basically abusing each other and telling each other all their worst qualities and characteristics. And it's really good. It's really good. It's really fun. And then it's illustrated by one of my favorite illustrators, which is Hicks Jenkins. And he just has amazing personal style to his work, and it's just so, so good. So that's definitely a winner. That's a great little book. And I don't normally read books. I couldn't focus on a novel because my mind was a bit all over the place. And a poem works, you know, a long poem works really well because of the sections. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm nearly at the end of To Kill a Mockingbird, which I never read before, and I'm enjoying that. And then my wife actually said I should read Kez. I'm kind of like, I've read plenty, but a lot of it was comic books. So now I feel like I'm taking the time to go back and read some of the classics because they're classics for a reason. I wonder whether there was just any other American literature that you remember as being like worth attention. Maybe if you didn't dig all the way through it or anything.
Arthur Miller, when I was studying, I read all of his plays. I really loved Arthur Miller. I mean, you know, the famous ones are Death of the Salesman or The Crucifix, is it? Or was it Crucible? I can't remember. Crucible, yeah. Maybe, you know, ones like that. I mean, again, a play is a bit like a poem for me, you know, the way it sort of, I enjoy that kind of format when reading it and in your head, and you can dramatize it in your head. So, but yeah, I really liked a lot of his work, actually. It was Arthur Miller. So he's the one that most.
I will check that out. So do you have a favorite band/album?
No, I know. I panicked when I saw that. I texted you going, oh my God, don't ask me about music. I don't listen to a lot of music, but I do listen to a lot of podcasts. I could tell you my favourite podcast instead, which might not be a surprise. It's Uncanny. Do you know Uncanny?
No, go on.
You've got to listen to Uncanny. It's like cult listening now. Basically, it's ghost stories, true life ghost stories by Danny Robbins. And it's so brilliant. A lot of my Stitch Club listen to it as well. So basically, it's really everyday people writing in with their ghost stories. And then, you know, like a fireman or, you know, a military policeman. People you wouldn't doubt their narrative, basically. And then having these experiences, there's an amazing one, a hiker going to a Scottish bothy and the experiences of poltergeist there. And then they have a skeptic and a believer, they're academics with PhDs in the paranormal, and they discuss what might have come about. There's a couple of series, and then there's a couple of really good dramatized summer episodes. And that is by far my favorite podcast at the moment.
I love it. Does that make you now, I mean, do you believe in ghosts? Because you've heard so many stories now, you can't not believe in them.
Yeah, kind of. Well, I kind of believe in a spirit anyway. I believe in energy. So I often walk in the forest and or even on the London Tube, you sit there and you know someone's staring at you. How do you know that? It's the energy, isn't it? There's an energy. So I can walk in the forest and I'll just stop dead still, turn my head, and there's a stag or something staring at me. How did I know that? It's an energy. So I think ghosts are energy.
I do want to say, for anybody who's listening who's not in England, we have thousands of stags just roaming around. Any wood you go into, probably a couple of stags in there. It's like you live in an amazing forest. I thought you were going to say squirrel, which is what happens around my way.
Do squirrels stare at you? It's like that devil squirrel.
They do. They look at me. I should not be eating as many nuts as I do when I take the dog out for a walk. I'm just heading for trouble. So do you, I mean, when you're working then, you're listening to podcasts, I guess, when you're working, or do you work in silence?
I do work in silence quite a lot, actually. I do spend a lot of my day in silence. I don't have, I like it. I like hearing nature. I do live in quite a rural spot, so I do like hearing nature. And I guess I have a lot going on up here, kind of entertaining me. So I quite like the world in my head, so I just indulge it. But then I do listen to podcasts, and I do watch telly. You know, I've watched telly as a kid. I've stitched and watched telly ever since I was a kid. So I still watch telly and stitch. It's like telly time. Yep, let's stitch.
Do you have a favourite, I mean, normally I ask about, do you have a favourite film? But like, have you had a favourite TV show as well? That kind of?
Yeah, well, I like a certain type of very British sitcom, I suppose it's called. But things like The Detectorists. You know, that's right up my street. I love The Detectorists. Oh, I love that meandering kind of program as well. I like White House and Mortimer when they go fishing. Love that. Meandering. Just, you know, sitting around with ghosts. Did you say ghosts?
Yeah.
What did you say? I love ghosts.
Yeah.
Love ghosts.
Got to be.
So I like that sort of program, and I love when Agatha Christie, Miss Marple. I often stitch from Miss Marple, a repeat of a Miss Marple, because it doesn't matter if I fade out because I know what's going on. But I suppose if it was more of a film, I'd like something like a Whale Rider, or I like a Sleepy Hollow kind of. You know that one? Do you remember that one? Johnny Depp with a fountain.
Yeah, Ichabod Crane and Johnny Depp. Yeah.
So I think I like ones which are quite mythological.
Yeah, but also quite natural, you know? If you go like The Old Man and the Sea, you go Sleepy Hollow, there's a lot of woods. You listen to Uncanny, there's a lot of ghosts. There's a thing here, spirits, animals, ghosts, spirits, animals, dead birds, spirits, animals, ghosts.
I spend a lot of time in my cat every night, pretty much. I go out to the forest in the dark and he likes to do parkour. So he literally runs up all the trees, hangs there, smacking me around the head with his paws. And I'm there in the dark. I try not to put my torch on because I don't want to scare people that there might be a burglar or something in the area. So, yeah. So I sit in a tree with the cat while he does his thing for half an hour most nights. I am a bit weird.
That's so good. You're such you're the right person in the right place. That's what you are, I think. Yeah. Would like to follow you, if people would like to learn from you, where should they go?
Well, Cloud Juno. So my website, cloudjuno.com, or Instagram, which is Chrissy_Juno_man. They're the only two places I'm at, really. But I'm hoping to relaunch my website soon, maybe New Year, maybe.
And if people want to get your black workbook, where could they get that?
They can buy that from me. I'm not on Amazon or anything. I went and produced the book in the wrong size for Amazon, which means I have to read.
Brilliant. We can have a very boring conversation about that one day, because obviously I know a bit about publishing and that sort of stuff. So we can have a...
me, either email or on my website. Yeah, basically.
Hey, Chrissy, thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Thank you for chatting with me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.